Once upon a time, an old merchant and his family of 12 children, 6 sons and 6 daughters, moved to a country town after recently losing much of their wealth. He ventured out one day to check on some merchandise, but on his return, a great storm grew, and he lost his way in the unfamiliar terrain. Seeking shelter, he happened upon a castle. He entered the grand building to discover a banquet, as though it had been prepared for him. After warming himself by the fire and filling his belly with food, he found a bed with soft sheets and thick blankets. It didn't take long for him to fall asleep. The question of who owned the castle and for whom that banquet had been prepared never crossed his mind. The merchant woke the following morning to discover that the storm had passed. So he got dressed, shrugged on his thick cloak, and stepped outside to find his way home in the daylight. Just before leaving, he spotted a rose garden and a bush with 7 bright red roses, each with 10 petals. The bright red roses reminded him of his daughter, his beauty. He plucked it, smelled it, and smiled. Today was a good day. Little did our kindly merchant know, however, that the storm was about to return. He heard the sound of crashing waves and turned to look and saw that the castle was on the edge of a great sea of glass, the water gleaming like crystal. There was no wind, but great waves crashed against the shore. A beast emerged from the sea, with 7 heads, large tusks, and covered in mangy fur. It looked at the rose in the merchant's hand and bellowed. A swarm flew from the castle doors and engulfed the merchant, a cloud of cups and spoons and candlesticks. They spoke to him through demonic mouths, and the words were blasphemous, demanding with foul breath that he be their guest. The beast stood before him, and the merchant cowered at its feet. It made demands, and the merchant obeyed. A stamp flew before him and marked his forehead. The merchant worshipped the beast and left to find his daughter to die in his place in service of that great horrible beast. She received a brand on her right hand, and she loved the beast. She wore a yellow dress and danced for the beast and taught it to read. In her eyes, the beast was a beautiful prince. A tale as old as time. That, as I'm sure you were able to piece together, was a mashup of a couple of different beastly stories. The image of a beast is a common motif, used to terrify and signify the most horrid, deranged, inhumane, and unlovable beings. But unlike the old fairy tale of the Beauty and the beast we are looking at today is not a true prince, but a parody of the true prince. This beast appears to be the bringer of peace and justice, but it only does so at the tip of a sword. Today, we are continuing our apocalyptic journey through the symbolism of Revelation and examining the beast described in chapter 13, a creature who is not the Antichrist to come in some distant future, but was a very specific man, a man who had his own number, a number which could be calculated. 666. This is the beast. Welcome to the Isms and Schisms podcast, and I hope you enjoyed my weird little narrative to open this episode. By no means am I suggesting that Beauty and the Beast is a good example of apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic texts tend to critique imperial powers using coded language, and I guess the Beauty and the Beast critiques vapid superficiality. True beauty is internal, not external, if you're a man, that is. If you haven't listened to the episodes on apocalypticism and the millennium, I'd probably suggest you listen to those first, as that would make this episode a little easier to follow, but you probably don't necessarily need to. But let's dive into it. Who or what is the beast? What is the author of Revelation trying to say here? Let's get straight to the primary source. Let's have a read of Revelation 13. I'm going to read it in full so that we can get a sense of the full scope of the imagery. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads. And on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its heads were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave it his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have received a death blow, but its fatal wound had been healed. In amazement, the whole earth followed the beast. They worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?" The beast was given a mouth speaking arrogant and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to speak blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to wage war on the saints and to conquer them. It was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all the inhabitants of the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered. Let anyone who has an ear listen. If you are to be taken captive, into captivity you go. If you kill with the sword you must be killed. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Then I saw another beast that rose out of the earth. It had 2 horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast on its behalf, and it makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose fatal wound had been healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in the sight of all. And by the signs that it is allowed to perform on behalf of the beast, it deceives the inhabitants of earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that had been wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast could even speak and cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be given a brand on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell who does not have the brand.
Access denied.
That is the name of the beast, or the number for its name. This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number for a person. Its number is 666. If you've been following my thoughts on apocalypticism from previous episodes, you would immediately notice all of the telltale signs of coded language and critiques of imperial power. But before we break the passage down into the various interpretations, there's more description in chapter 17. In this chapter, the harlot of Babylon makes an appearance. She comes in riding the beast, and this is what is said about the beast and its 7 heads. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. Also, they are 7 kings, of whom 5 have fallen, 1 is living, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th, but it belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not received a kingdom. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. These are united in yielding their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. Okay, cool. Great. That's pretty weird and pretty intense. So how does one interpret this imagery? Like the millennium of chapter 20, your interpretation of the beast depends on how you approach the book of Revelation in general. And as a quick recap, the futurist approach places all of the events of Revelation as actual events to take place in the future. The historicist approach connects the events and individuals with particular moments throughout human history. Some have occurred and some are still yet to come. The preterist approach argues that all the imagery coincides with events that occurred in the first century. And the idealist approach makes everything theoretical rather than rooted within a specific time. Far and away, the most common interpretation of the beast from a historicist perspective is that the beast is the Catholic Pope. This was a very common interpretation during the Protestant Reformation, held by the likes of Martin Luther and that great polymath Isaac Newton. It is not as common today, but there are still some who hold to this position, particularly by some within the Seventh-day Adventist Church, though this is falling out of favor within Adventist teaching. The beast was also identified, especially within the medieval period, as the Islamic prophet Muhammad. Others have interpreted it as the Umayyad Caliphate, or the American Congress, or a supercomputer in Belgium, and one man by the name of Aleister Crowley even insisted that he was the beast.
Oh, really?
What I find telling in these interpretations is the desire to identify the apocalyptic character with the great enemies of the time. Except for Aleister Crowley, I don't really know what's going on there. In the Middle Ages, Islam was the great nemesis of the Christian church. So of course the beast must be Muhammad. Then in the Protestant Reformation, the great nemesis of the Protestant movement was the Catholic Church. So of course the beast must be the Pope. Did they never stop and question, wait, wasn't Muhammad the beast? It's weaponizing revelation, forcing it to say what we want it to say, to provide the theological justification that supports our current cause. The futurist perspective places the beast as a literal figure to come at some point in the future, and it is usually equated with the Antichrist. The Antichrist requires a whole episode to unpack, but within this interpretation, comparisons are often drawn between Revelation 13 and 17, and other passages that discuss this idea of Antichrist, such as 1 John chapters 2 and 4, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and Matthew 24, describing this person who deceives people into worshipping himself rather than God, who performs signs and who leads people in rebellion. So there are some similarities between the beast and the Antichrist, but there are also a lot of pretty major differences that conveniently get ignored. Plus, in 1 John chapter 2, verse 18, we read that many antichrists will come and in fact are already here. So does that mean that there are many beasts? They're already here? Make it make sense. Within a preterist perspective, which if you've been paying attention, you would know that this is generally the position I lean towards. The beast is the Roman Emperor Nero, who reigned between the years 54 and 68 of the first century, and who persecuted the Jews, including the Christians, in the city of Rome, who executed them by burning them alive, and then when Rome burnt down, he blamed it on the Jews. Some believed that it was actually him who burned the city down. This guy had a real thing about fire, the little violin-playing pyromaniac. But I'll unpack this argument in a moment. The idealist perspective is similar to the preterist, but doesn't limit it to Nero. Any or all tyrannical rulers who are opposed to the Christian God and who persecutes Christians is the beast. Or more generally, all human kingdoms. This connects to Daniel chapter 7, where there are four beasts: a lion with eagle wings, a bear with tusks, a leopard with wings on its back and head, and a terrifying and strong beast that was made up of all of the other beasts and was covered in horns. Each of these beasts are considered kingdoms in Daniel. Revelation picks up on this imagery and rolls them all to one. And so the interpretation is that this signifies all kingdoms rolled into one giant metaphorical kingdom. I did mention that I lean towards preterism, but I have sympathies towards idealism, somewhere between the two. While I don't think there is some secret cabal dictating governments from the shadows, this is not prophesying the New World Order or the Illuminati or some complex liberal plot to turn everyone gay. Real theories that I've come across. Historically, there has been lots of exploitation and abuse handed down from people in authority and still happens today. Perhaps this abuse is what the beast signifies and is something that we should be constantly looking out for and trying to undo. Now, let's turn to unpacking the symbolism in this passage. We can't get to all of it, at least not in detail, because there's just too much, and this episode's already dragging on. But I'll hit the key themes. In general, my understanding, which I think tends to be the accepted position by most critical scholars, is that the first beast refers to the Roman emperor. The second beast is the Roman imperial cult. That is the imperial apparatus that encouraged or coerced people into worshipping, or at least giving fealty and paying their taxes to the Roman Empire, and that the harlot of Babylon is Rome itself. The harlot of Babylon is described as being dressed in purple, the imperial colour. She's adorned with jewellery and holding a golden cup. She's described as a wealthy imperial aristocrat. She's also drunk with the blood of martyrs, a clear reference to imperial persecution. And on her forehead is written the title Babylon the Great. As we've noticed, Babylon is mentioned in lots of apocalyptic literature and is often used as a way of describing the oppressive powers of their time. In Daniel, Babylon represented the Seleucid Empire and the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is because Babylon was Israel's great nemesis, the people who destroyed the first temple in Jerusalem. Following Babylon's lead, Antiochus desecrated the second temple, and then the Romans destroyed the second temple in the year 70 CE. So Babylon kind of becomes the archetype figure of Israel's great nemesis. Hence why the Seleucid Empire and then the Roman Empire would be called Babylon. She is also described as the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. So we know then that she is a city, that this is a reference to a city. Rome was the capital city of the Roman Empire and was the center of government of that empire, which literally ruled over the kings of the known world at the time. The harlot of Babylon, or Babylon the Great, then, is Rome. It most assuredly does not refer to the Catholic Church, as some have argued. The first beast has seven heads, which are said to be seven mountains and also seven kings. There are seven major hills in the city of Rome, and these hills, or mountains, became really important to Rome's origin myth. So again, another reference to the Roman Empire. And why the reference to the kings? Well, it mentions that five kings had passed, one currently ruled, and one was to come, who wouldn't be around for long, as we read in chapter 17, verse 10. Though Revelation was probably written closer to the turn of the century, around the time of Domitian's persecution of the Christians, the narrative is located in the time of Nero. Nero was the sixth Caesar of the Roman Empire, and the one to follow Nero, named Galba, was emperor for only 6 months. So five have been, one currently rules, at least in the narrative, and the next, the seventh, wouldn't last for long. This beast spoke blasphemous words and was worshipped. Nero was called Almighty God and Savior, and was allowed to exercise authority and wage war against the saints for 42 months. And would you like to guess how long Nero's persecution lasted? That's right, 42 months. Between the years 64 CE, in the months leading up to the Great Fire in Rome, which Nero blamed on the Jews, up until his death in June 68 CE. This period is sometimes known as the Neronic persecution. The second beast then emerges, exercising the authority of the first beast, making everyone worship that first beast. So that kind of sounds just like the imperial apparatus. And then we come to the infamous Mark of the Beast, and then the number 666. Apparently, everyone is given a brand on their right hand or their forehead, without which no one could buy or sell. What this is an allusion to the Shema, the great Jewish prayer that Jesus prayed, that is found in Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. Keep these words that I am commanding you today in your heart. Bind them as a sign on your hand. Fix them as an emblem on your forehead. It's essentially an oath of commitment to serve only Yahweh and no other. So in Revelation, it's flipped to become an oath of commitment to serve only the beast. It's got nothing to do with microchips or COVID vaccines or credit cards or anything like that. It's all allegory. If you don't give fealty to the Roman emperor, you will be a social pariah. But be encouraged. Stay true to Christ. Remain obedient to the one true God, says the author of Revelation. So we now come across the number of the beast in Revelation 17, 18. This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast. Here, the author is winking at his Jewish readers. He's saying, huddle round. I've got a secret to tell you. And this idea of calculating a number was a common Jewish practice called gematria, where the letters of the Hebrew alphabet are ascribed a numerical value. And so words and names would have a calculable number, such as the Hebrew word chai, meaning life. And that was probably a terrible pronunciation, but whatever. It means life, which adds up to 18. And so the number 18 became a lucky number in some Jewish tradition. And the Hebrew word for Satan equals 364. And so there was this little idea that Satan would rule all year round except for the Day of Atonement, when sacrifices were made to atone for the sins of Israel. So the author is here telling his audience to whip out their calculators. He continues, it is the number for a person. So again, the author is again winking at his audience, giving them the heads up, saying, I'm talking about someone specific here, but I don't want that person to find out I'm talking about them, so pay attention. He's got a specific person in mind, and that number, he says, is 666. And would you like to guess what name adds up to 666? You're never going to guess it. Yep, that's right. Caesar Nero. So who is the beast? It's not some evil antichrist figure to come one day. It's not the Pope. It's Emperor Nero. There's even references to Nero's death and to a conspiracy theory known as Nero Redivivus. But this episode is really dragging on, so I'll let you Google those. But what's Nero doing in there? Well, the author of Revelation is, in classic apocalyptic style, critiquing the tyrannical imperial powers of the time. But why? Well, because the author is wanting to encourage his readers to remain faithful, to stand firm in the face of oppression, to not give up the faith despite whatever may come. When you get down to it, Revelation is a book of hope and encouragement and faithfulness and worship. And all of that is still applicable to today. Persecution today is way, way, way different to what it was like in the first century. And let's be real, in the Western church, we don't really suffer from persecution. That might not be the case in other parts of the world, but as Christians in the Western world, we've actually got it really, really good, unlike the Jews and the Christians of the first century. Nevertheless, it's always a good reminder to turn our attention to what matters. So, who is the beast in Revelation? Say it with me, loud and proud, Nero. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. This episode was recorded on the traditional lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. I look forward to examining more isms and schisms with you.